Thank you very much for having me here. This is now a little change in the program because this will be the first observational talk. I'll be talking about the BRIGHT project, and in the likely case that not everybody knows what this is all about, let me just briefly introduce to you what this mission is all about. And the scientific results that I will present later would not have been possible without the collaborations of several colleagues who provided material to me. So thanks to Bram, Thomas, Rainer, Tony, Coralie, Bert, Andrzej, Tahina, and Greg. Concerning BRIGHT, BRIGHT is an acronym for BRIGHT Target Explorer. These are nanosatellites, 20 by 20 centimeters. They carry 3 centimeter telescopes for observations of the of bright stars, and bright, I mean, brighter than fifth magnitude. They are in low Earth orbits, and they take time-resolved two-color photometry. So this is the first time, of course, that we can do time-resolved color photometry from space, which helps to identify pulsation modes. If I may be so cheeky and compare with Kepler, our noise level that we're getting with the bright data is about 100 times higher, still 10 times better than ground-based, but our stars are about 1,000 times brighter. So if you want to do ground-based spectroscopy for support observations, so instead of applying for KEK time, you ask a fellow amateur astronomer and get spectra of a second magnitude stars, and you get a high signal-to-noise spectra. So ground-based follow-up, especially high-resolution spectroscopy, becomes so much easier if you're doing these really bright stars, and this is actually the strength of the mission. The mission is like hosted by 3 countries. That's Austria, Poland, and Canada. Two of each type of satellites are funded by these partner countries, and there is one blue satellite and one red satellite by each country. Unfortunately, we lost BRIGHT Montreal because it didn't detach from the last stage of the rocket that was supposed to bring it into space. So we have 5 satellites up and operating. Observations, so this is just, I don't want you to read all this, but this is just an overview of the first 18 observing campaigns that we've done with BRIGHT. We've been starting at late 2013. We're observing up to 50 stars per field. We are trying to get time bases of about 30 days, which works in most cases. Sometimes we just have filler fields as well. And we have currently observed about 410 stars with that mission. What we're doing is that this is a full field image of Orion. So if you turn your head 90 degrees, you will recognize the constellation. Depends on what hemisphere you're living in, you have to decide what direction to swap. And we are defining like little observing windows, subrasters that we're downloading. We don't have the capacity to download full frame images because we're working at very high cadence. Every 20 seconds we're getting a data point. So we are loading down, downloading these images. So this is a blue image of actually these 15 stars that I've just shown in Orion. In the blue, bright Austria, and the red, Unibright. So we are having these rasters. These images are slightly defocused intentionally because of the large field of view. You get some interesting PSFs that will take into account during the data reduction, and we perform aperture photometry on that. Observations that we did so far to get the most stars, we observe obviously in the densest fields, which are around in the galactic plane, where there's most stars, or which are dominated by massive stars. And this is the relevance of the mission actually for massive stars. So these are the 18 fields that have been fully observed so far. Concerning the observations themselves, one thing that we encountered very early in the mission was that our CCD detectors suffered actually very high radiation damage. So here on the left, you see some raw images, guess where's the star? So what we're doing now is that we're actually moving the satellites. We integrate for 1 second, and then we move the satellite about 10 arc minutes off, and then take another integration. And so we get two images of the star, so we're going back and forth. We're getting two images of the stars, and we just subtract them from each other. And then we get the difference images, and here are our stars. Here on the bottom, so these are two PSFs. So then with some smoothing, we find out where the star really is, and define the contours of the stellar shape into the photometry back there. To be fair, we also have an example of a failed chopping motion, where actually the two PSFs of the stars touch, so this data cannot be used, we just remove them. Okay, this is the basic observational things, but you are interested in astrophysics rather than observational details, so let me just show you. These are things that are already published, so this is about pulsating Beta Cephei stars. I will mostly go through those rather quickly because I don't have the time to discuss those stars in detail. I've also noticed during this conference that people have different concepts of what's a massive star. For some stars, for some people, this is everything that become a supernova type 2. For others, these are stars that are in the triple figures in terms of mass. So for each star that I'll discuss here, I will actually show you what mass these are, and you can decide for yourself if you think this is a massive star or not. So this is Beta Centauri, a binary for which two modes from spectroscopy that has been known before Bright, we find 17 pulsation modes for that star, pressure modes and gravity modes. Paper published by Andrzej Pigulski last year in ANA. Alpha Loopy, another similar example. Before Bright, one pulsation mode known, radial pulsation mode. With Bright, we get 14, mostly again at the low frequencies and some P modes here. New Eridania start that almost 15 years ago now, Connie. We started extensively from the ground. With Bright, we found, so this is just Fourier spectra with pre-whitening, we find many new pulsation modes. Sigma Scorpii, this is a star that, again, Connie has been started by her postdoc, Andrew Tkachenko, by spectroscopy quite a bit. I did some ground-based photometry, and this is just some schematic frequency spectra. This is what the star looked like, the pulsation spectrum looked like in 1972, and this is what it looked like 40 years later. The amplitude dropped significantly. We looked at that with Bright, courtesy to Andrzej Pigulski. He finds, again, the known pulsation modes. It seems they're kind of growing back. If he removes those, he finds more oscillation modes and, again, some stuff at the low frequency. And this is suspicious. We look at all these Beta Cephei stars that are like between 8 and 15 solar masses. They should be poor P-mode pulsators, as theorists predict. But we find all those G-modes. This is Alpha Loopy pre-widened by the P-modes, just a low-frequency domain. We see G-modes here. New Eridani, we see G-modes here. PT Papis, we see G-modes here, and so on and so on and so on. And as Esan has already mentioned, this is actually a problem. The problem is that our models, even if you modify the opacity to explain the excitation of the models, of the oscillation frequencies, so this is a stability diagram where you plot frequency, pulsation frequency versus stability parameter, so everything that's above zero here is excited in the model, which are for L equals one modes, the red triangles, and for the L equals two modes, the green squares. You can match the P-mode frequencies pretty well, but you always have a problem identifying or matching the G-modes. Whatever you do, whatever you do to your opacities, whatever opacities you're using, so these are Los Alamos Oplip, which are the best for our stars, or at least they're best comparable with our data. But as you can see here with the mode excitation, you are actually hitting a wall here at this frequency, and many of the stars actually have frequencies lower than that excited. And whatever we do to our models, we cannot do anything about that. So suggestions welcome. Another star that will not be a supernova, even if it merges with its companion, but this is also an interesting result. This is a slowly pulsating B star, HD phone number, started by Thomas Kallinger and collaborators. This is the bright Fourier spectrum. And what Thomas noticed is actually the Fourier peaks, which are the black lines here, actually broader than the spectral window, which is red dotted lines here. So with a Bayesian method, he showed that, or he found that actually he needs two oscillations to reproduce the observations. And if you pre-button that, you actually get a sequence of G modes, which was actually also what Esan showed for some of the Kepler stars. We have some SMI data that are actually worse in quality than bright data, but they have better time resolution. So this is the frequency spectrum. So the three dominant modes are there, and we can actually resolve them into triplets. So with that, we can actually determine a internal rotation period of a bit less than a year, but the surface rotates with a period of about 3 days, which is synchronized with actually the binary orbit. It's a triple system with a close pair and a wider pair. So this is a very extreme differential rotation in that star, probably due to interaction with the binary companion. Which brings me to binarity. This is the light curve of Delta Peak. So 16 and, nine solar masses, so close binary, so you see distortion effects. If you remove the binary solution, what you see pulsations, you see p-mode pulsations. This is the dominant frequency, and you see signals that are actually split with the orbital frequency from that. So that also indicates an interaction between pulsation and binary orbit, but it gets better than that. This is Yota Orionis. Yota Orionis, recent paper by Bert Pablo that actually got the officially published one of the notices, I think, yesterday. this is the light curve, and you see this suspicious bump here. And this is actually a heartbeat signal. Does everybody know what heartbeat stars are? Heartbeat stars are close binaries that are gravitationally distorted by the influence of the companion, but in very elliptical orbits. So that means the distortion effects become much more pronounced at periastron. That means all the ellipsoidal variation is actually concentrated near periastron, and this gives rise to actually these light curves. That one can model. These are radial velocities observed simultaneously with that, and Bert has modeled the binary. And in addition, we obviously determine the orbital period. And in addition, what we see in the frequency spectra after taking out the binary variability, this is blue bright satellite, this is red bright satellite. You see the same signals in both filters, you see significant signals. And they are integer multiples of the orbital period. So these are this is probably the first case of tidally excited oscillations in an O-type star. So the oscillations actually come from the 23 solar mass primary component. And I think this is Jim's work of that paper, that Jim has actually modeled the tidal excitation of these modes, and with the higher frequency signals, he actually found quite good agreement. And also the luminosity amplitudes they are getting, they agree quite well with what's observed. Binary stars, magnetic stars. Next thing. One of the things that we also did is that we have that there are a couple of stars that are known magnetic pulsators. This is summarized in a conference proceedings paper by Bram Boiskart, a PhD student of these two ladies. If you look which of those stars are in our bright sample, you just look at all the betas and epsilons and zetas and sigmas, and these are our these stars already observed by Bright. So we can do astroseismology of that. Beta Centauri I've already talked about. Beta CMA is currently in progress by Brahm himself. Epsilon Lupi, I'll talk about later a little bit. Xi 1 CMA, I have those data. I can only tell you that this is a radial mode and nothing else within 40 ppm. So there's nothing except the radial mode in there. Zeta Cas, this is probably Tony Moffat's star. Sigma Lupi, Coralie is working on that. And Phi Centauri is worked on by Marilyn Briquet. And from the Bright Pole Survey, what we also did is, as ground-based preparation work, to observe the brightest stars in the sky, mostly as backup programs even, with NAVAL and Espadon, to determine, to look for magnetic fields in those stars. This is Beta Centauri, so this is just the disentangled spectrum of that star from a paper by Mario Ocelos 12 years ago. And this, the interesting thing about Beta Centauri is that one of the components rotates really rapidly. And it's also the one that's non-radially pulsating, and the other component has much sharper lines. And the reason for that is that the sharp line component is actually magnetic. So there seems to be some magnetic breaking in that secondary component in Beta Centauri. And these are the Stokes LSD profiles that just show that the variability of the magnetic field is actually confined to what the narrow line component is doing. Epsilon Lupi, so I talked about heartbeat stars, I talked about magnetic stars. This is a magnetic heartbeat star. So this is the heartbeat signal, and these are the radial velocities. So this is another case. Unfortunately, this star has been claimed in literature as a pulsating star. Unfortunately, we don't see that. So you can't have it all. I should also add that actually we have more massive heartbeat stars. I mean, of the low-mass heartbeat stars that have been found with Kepler, there's a couple of dozen, maybe 100 now. We have at least three massive ones now with Bright, and obviously, I mean, we hope for more. I mean, they seem to be more common. So, lessons from Bright, other than my collaborators, not in alphabetical order. First of all, relieving for those people who are running this mission, precision photometric studies with nanosatellites, with, so I still have 2 minutes, so I can complain now, in low Earth orbits with very changing conditions with uncalibrated CCD detectors that have very strong radiation damage is possible if you work on your methods. The first result really is that gravity mode pulsation among Beta Cephei stars is rather common, more common than we thought, and it's a problem for the models. We can test the interior rotation of solar pulsating B stars, not as good as with Kepler because we don't have quite the time base, but still we can do something. Magneto astroseismology is on the horizon. We have some preliminary results. One thing that I did not talk about is that we also have some nice results on pulsation Maslow's interaction B stars, meaning that Maslow seems to be modified with the beat period of two pulsation modes. Massive heartbeat stars, they exist and they can be investigated. And it seems to be that for the first time we have a link between large-scale wind structures and their photospheric origin. One word of caution, these results that I'm presenting here, the first results came out like 1 year ago, and the latest results I'm presenting are actually just in the making. So I think we're only just scratching the surface of things, and more exciting results are hopefully to be expected still. Thanks.
There is a question there.
So your binary that had the very slowly rotating core and the synchronous surface, is that a circular binary, an eccentric binary?
That's a circular one.
It's circular.
Yes.
Okay.
That's, yeah, that's not helpful. But yeah.
So the last, the massive source that you talked about, the 56 solar mass.
Yeah.
You said there's a density wave kind of Is that a, do you have the estimate on the, from the spectra, the mass? I mean, how much mass is out there the from the wind? It's mass loss, it's a product of mass loss, right?
Yes. I can tell you how much mass is there is in there, but maybe Stan can.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, so this is actually a very interesting story that, you know, you see these discrete absorption components all the time in massive star spectra. They're ubiquitous. But Zeta Puppis was one of the stars that we got to study with ultraviolet prolonged use with IUE for 20 days. And basically, the idea, it goes back to the idea that when you have a, well, if you have a bright spot on the star, it drives a stronger mass loss from that spot. But then what happens is as you recede from the spot, the extra driving goes away because the spot now only has a small filling factor. So the wind kind of slows down. And what you actually see is the spiral pattern in the ultraviolet spectra is really just a plateau in the velocity. And the amount of mass is not really changing very much. In other words, it's just the mass of the stellar wind, but it's being modulated by the bright spot. So it's not like it's ejecting an extra amount of mass or very much extra mass. It's a pattern that's induced by the perturbation of having a bright spot on the star. And we speculated that this, you only, in order to explain these discrete absorption components, you had to have bright spots. But back then in the 1990s, nobody had any way of, you know, being able to detect spots of that amplitude. And now with bright and these other things, we have ability to do it. And then to connect with what Matteo does, the idea might be that if you have a magnetic spot on a massive star, instead of blocking the convective flux and blow and making it dark like it does in cool stars, it basically makes the radiation pressure, the magnetic pressure makes the density lower and lets more light out of the star. So spots on stars with radiative envelopes are bright and spots on stars with convective envelopes are dark. And it's these
bright spots. Have another question.
I am part of the et al. In the Tahina paper on Zeta Puppis. Now it's an extremely interesting object because the reason why I'm in the et al. Member is of course to see what is the evolutionary consequence of everything that we observe there in Zeta Puppis. Now Zeta Puppis is one of the fastest rotators, but is also one of the fastest runaway stars. How do you produce that by means of a binary scenario? Because it has been a binary before. It is a gift from the gods as far as binaries is concerned. Now, curiously enough, you can only model that thing if you assume that stars above 50 solar masses in a binary do explode.
Okay, we have a question from Joris.
Yeah, stellar winds have not only large-scale structures, but also small-scale structures clumping. And do you see any evidence for that? Could you have some sort of, I don't know, from the small-scale variations of your light curves, learn something about the wind clumping?
Yes, there is some additional variability in there that they have actually looked into. And they suspect that this is actually small-scale structure as well. I mean, you also see it in the spectra. Yeah.
Okay. So for the bright spots on Zeta Puppis, I think it's really very exciting. I'm wondering two things. One is, what is the lifetime of these spots? I guess you have sufficient data to tell us, although I couldn't grasp it from.
Okay, if I extrapolate, well, these are rotational cycles, so you can count the
magnetic spots. That's a much more difficult measurement to make. So we have proposed for that last semester. Did not get the data, we're proposing again. But it's definitely, because we have some constraints on the brightness of the spots, we can make some predictions regarding the magnetic field strength. And in this case, we're talking about something on the order of 300 Gauss. So we will definitely be looking to try to detect small-scale magnetic fields in this star.
Okay, thank you. We have time for one more question, if somebody wants to. No? Okay. Then we will break for a coffee. We will have a coffee break. We'll be back at 11 to learn much more about magnetic fields.